Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders. Last year, along with John Nichols, the great progressive journalist with The Nation magazine, I wrote a best-selling book called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. In it, we tackle the issues that you don't hear much about in the mainstream media, from the extraordinary wealth and income inequality that our nation is experiencing, to the growing labor movement, to corporate control over the media itself. If I must say so myself, this is a very good book, and it's just been republished in paperback. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.
In this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about unions, which is a topic that the senator enjoys discussing quite a bit. Now, I wanted to start out, though, and go into it. You know, we do talk a great deal about work in the book. We've got two chapters on it, work as it sort of exists today and the future of work. And clearly, we are in a great transition point where people are kind of rethinking their own relationship with their work. My sense is that the pandemic had a huge impact on that, that it did cause people to pause and rethink. And I'm wondering if you think that really it was out of the pandemic that we in many ways laid the base for this incredible rise in trade union organizing, but also a rise in rethinking how many hours a week we should work and things like that.
Well, I do think so, John. I don't know that the pandemic alone is the cause of all of this transformation, but it's an important fact. What does that mean when we talk about the pandemic and work? To me, what it means is that you had a terrible virus going around, which has killed over something like 1.1 million Americans, and God knows how many were sick, some very seriously sick, and many with long COVID today. So it's a terrible, terrible pandemic. And in the midst of the pandemic, you had two realities. For working class people, if they wanted to feed their families, there wasn't much choice. You had to go out, go into the factory and work. You had to go into the office and work. You had to drive the bus. Mm-hmm. You had to be a cop. You had to be a firefighter. You had to go out and work, even though you might get sick in the process.
And I talked to I did a piece on bus drivers at the early stage of the pandemic, where there were bus drivers who were saying they slept in their cars when they weren't driving because they didn't want to go home. They knew they were getting sick.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to go home and get their families.
And we think about, you know, the nurses and the doctors who were treating patients in hospitals without protective equipment, literally putting their lives on the line. So you had one reality that working class people had no choice. You want to feed your family, you go to work. Then there's another reality, that if you're a CEO or a wealthy person, you're going to stay away from other people. You're not going to get the virus. You're going to do your work virtually. You're going to do it on your computer, maybe at home, maybe in a nice isolated office. You're going to protect yourself. So you have a situation where tens and tens of thousands of workers died because they had no choice. They had to go to work to feed their families. And I think that was kind of a wake-up call about the nature of the economy today. And you know, people then starting to say, you know, what is the meaning of my life? Is that really all that I want to do, et cetera, et cetera? But I think that was, to my mind at least, the major wake-up call and message of the pandemic.
And an awful lot of working-class people, you know, they made it through, the ones who survived the pandemic. And for a while there, they were being told they were essential workers. They were being told that they were really, you know, heroically saving the country. But then when they went back into their workplace, into the store, into the factory, wherever, they were told, well, yeah, you're really essential, but we're not going to raise your pay. We're not going to give you better working conditions. And my sense, I think it's something we talk about a good deal in the book, is that a lot of those people, like a light bulb went off, says, well, maybe we ought to be in a union where we can actually make those demands.
Well, I remember exactly what you were saying. We did an event here in D.C. with people who worked in nursing homes. Now, try working in the nursing home in the midst of COVID. And many of the aides certainly got sick and some died. And that's exactly what they were saying. They go to work under very dangerous conditions. They were regarded as heroines and heroes, and yet they're still making 14 or 15 bucks an hour. And their work was not rewarded as the pandemic phased out. But I think on top of all of that, and I think the COVID pandemic was an accelerator in the process, sure, but not the end. I think here's the reality that, again, we don't talk about very much in American society. It's an unbelievable reality. And that is, over the last 50 years, from 1973 to today, 51 years, despite all of the revolutions we have seen in technology and worker productivity, think how different the world was. I was became mayor of Burlington, Vermont in 1981. There was not a computer in the building. Nobody had cell phones. Nobody had emails. You know, I think we still use mimeograph machines or something. And think about the explosion of technology. And yet, that average American worker in real inflation accounted for dollars is worse off than he or she was 50 years ago, while the people on top are making out like bandits. Massive transfer of wealth from working class to the people on top. So I think all of these things, people saying, look, I'm working. My kid is like, I'm going nowhere. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. My kid likely will have even a lower standard of living. My daughter can't afford, you know, housing. My son is paying off his student debt. What's going on? Why is that? So you're seeing people take a hard look at unions in America and beginning to understand that if you're alone, there's a limit to what you can accomplish at the workplace. When you organize with your brothers and sisters who are on the job, and you sit down and you negotiate a decent contract, you can have a much better opportunity to earn decent wages and good working conditions and benefits.
And you like it when unions are not just present, but when they are on the march, when they are organizing, when they're building into something. And I remember, it was funny, we were doing something as regards this paperback edition that was just coming out. We were going to get together in Burlington to work over a chapter of it, because we added some new chapters to the book. And then you said, well, I can't meet today because the UAW is going on strike. I've got to fly to Detroit. And yeah, I mean, you could have waited a day, but no, you had to be there the day that they went out. And to you, I think this is very exciting to you, to see this moment that we are in where unions are actually...
It is. It's, you know, I don't have to explain to any of our viewers or people listening. These are really, really challenging times. I mean, you know, whether it's climate change or a dysfunctional healthcare system or the child care crisis, the housing crisis, you name it, we're dealing with it. But there is one very good piece of news, and that as working class people all over this country, from young people at Starbucks to veteran unions like the UAW and the Teamsters, who have new leadership, by the way, and that's part of it. Workers said, we're tired of the old leadership. They gave us very bad contracts, sold out in many respects. We want new leadership, and they got new leadership. And people like Sean Fain in the UAW, and Sean O'Brien in the Teamsters, and Sarah Nelson in the flight attendants, and many others. Mm-hmm. These are a new generation of union leadership that is now prepared to stand up to corporate America and say, you know what, you're going to give our members a decent paycheck and good working conditions. And that's something new. And it is transformative. It is enormously important for the future of this country.
And they're also making bigger and bolder and frankly more adventurous demands, right? It isn't just the standard, which is totally fine, by the way, you know, better pay, better working conditions in the job as it's now defined. They're actually talking about redefining the job, right? To seize technology and make it work for workers. And one of the things that was striking about the UAW strike was that on their list of demands was a 32-hour work week, which was ridiculed by much of the business press and business TV commentators and stuff like that. But it's not that ridiculous, is it? It's actually a very practical proposal.
Look, nobody knows what the full extent of artificial intelligence and robotics will be. Nobody can predict that. But everybody knows that it is going to be absolutely transformative. So if you're out there listening or watching this, the job, there is an excellent chance that the job you have today may not be there in 10 or 20 years, will look very, very different than it looks right now. That's all. Everybody knows that. So the question, the very simple question is, if artificial intelligence and robotics and other technologies are going to transform the economy, who benefits and who loses? So if I give you, if I'm an employer and I give you a tool that makes you more productive, do I say, hey, John, look, I got a machine now that could do your work. Here's a gold wristwatch. Thank you very much for your service. I don't need you anymore because I got a machine that could do what you do. Or John, or is the alternative to say that we have new technology that increases worker productivity and workers are going to benefit from that? And I say, well, John, you know what? It's a machine that does a lot of work. You only have to work 32 hours rather than 40 hours, and you're going to get the same pay. And you're going to have more time for your family, more time for leisure, more time for education. So this struggle about who benefits from the transformative technologies that are out there is going to be a very central theme in the coming years.
And one of the things we talk about in the book, and we use a lot of examples from other countries around the world. And in Germany, they've been planning for this for quite a while. They've had multiple kind of assessments of how this is going to change society to have all this technological change, robotification, AI, etc. And they already have a number of industries that are going to or exploring the 32-hour week.
Right. It's eminently sensible. And if you want to take it a step further, and there's some people who have been writing about this, you know, if you think about human history, it's always been a struggle. I mean, from earliest days, people hunted and gathered and fished just to feed their families. Survival. We now are at a moment, because of this explosion of technology developed by the human mind, where so much work can be done by machines. And that means the opportunity really to go a very long way to limiting poverty or eliminating poverty, to making life much more productive and enjoyable than it is. We can be thinking in the years to come about working families no longer having to work to survive, that people actually can have the time to enjoy life to its fullest in a way that we can't today.
But it could go the other direction. It could be a hell because, and we actually see that in some industries where you've got the machinery, you've got the robotification, and human beings are expected to keep up with.
Amazon would be a good example.
Amazon, I'm talking exactly about Amazon.
Yeah.
And so you end up in situations where instead of getting any benefit from this technological progress, people are actually forced to work harder for less.
And the corruption of our political system is that there is not even, well, maybe there is the beginning of a debate about who controls this technology and who benefits from the technology. The general ideology out there right now says, look, hey, I'm a CEO. We just purchased all this technology. We're going to apply it. Hey, you have nothing to say about it. We benefit. You don't. Right? And that's got to be changed. Because this is an extraordinary moment of huge potential, or as you indicated, can be devastating harm to working people. The other thing I want to say, I want to go back to unions.
Mm-hmm. Well, because unions come in big here.
Well, of course unions come in. Unions are the means by which workers will get a seat at the table to determine how this new who benefits from this new technology. But there's something else. You know, we've talked about a nation facing a mental health crisis, a crisis of loneliness, of alienation and so forth. And what unions do, and I've seen this time and time again, is you have people coming together to say, okay, how do we work together to raise our wages? You know, General Motors made huge profits last year. How do we get our fair share? And suddenly workers are not just recipients. They're not just at the...
They're not begging.
It's not only begging, they're not only just receiving, they are telling.
Right.
And in that process, people become more human. They're saying, look, what do we need? How do we do it? What's our tactics? So when people are standing together, that in itself improves the quality of life for people, I think. We're not just cogs in a machine. We're not just people who take what the boss gives us. We are human beings to say, by the way, this is what we want.
So let's keep digging into this a little bit, because one of the things that we saw not that many years ago, I come from Wisconsin, and you came out to Wisconsin to stand with public employees and others who were objecting to Scott Walker, the former governor's efforts to basically gut labor law, to make it almost impossible for unions to organize and collectively bargain. And at that time, there were a lot of pundits, a lot of political consultants who were saying, you know, unions are the past, right? Their time has passed.
Yep.
In reality, one of the things we argue in the book is that we're actually coming into a time where unions are more necessary than ever. Like, they become more vital.
More necessary than ever to counter the incredible power of the billionaire class in corporate America. These guys have all of the power. Who's going to stop them? Who's going to tell them that they cannot do anything they want to the American people? And the only institutions that I know that can stop them are organized labor.
And organized labor is also, it's a factor, obviously, in the workplace, but it's also a factor in politics, right? Because when people become organized into a union, one of the things that a union does at its best is educate people about what they can expect, not just from their employer, but from government itself. And I think that's one of the reasons why Republicans have spent so much time attacking unions.
Absolutely. You know, when people get involved in a union and they understand what's going on in their own company, then they understand what's going on in the country in many respects. And they begin to pay attention to what's going on in Washington. Why do we have this trade union? Why has the minimum wage not been raised? Why do we have an NLRB, which used to be terrible, now much better? What is an NLRB? What is Congress working on? Why is it that a good part of my paycheck is going to health care when other people in other countries have guaranteed health care through national health care programs? These are the questions that begin to arise and workers are beginning to think about.
So we're talking about the contemporary moment. How did you connect in with unions? What was it that made, because this is not a new theme for you.
No.
This is something you've been conscious of for a long time. Where did you, when you think back, where did you make that connection in your own head?
Well, you know, I hate exploitation. I hate people with power picking on people who don't have power. I hate employers exploiting workers. And obviously the antidote to that is unions. And when I was a student at the University of Chicago, actually, I got a job with the Packing House Workers of America. You remember that?
United Packing House Workers, one of the most progressive unions in American
history.
Run
by a guy named Ralph Helstein at the time.
Yes, indeed.
And his daughter was actually a classmate of mine at the University of Chicago.
And Charlie Hayes. Who
That's right, Charlie Hayes.
Great leader of the union who
and
went on to
Congress.
Be elected to Congress.
Yeah, I knew Charlie.
Yeah. And helped Harold Washington get elected mayor of Chicago.
There you go.
All right.
And the Packing House Workers are a good example of a union, my God. The working conditions and the, you know.
Yeah, I bet you a lot of people who are listening don't know about it. Explain what it's like to work in a packing house.
Well, as somebody who's worked in a packing house for
30
years.
But you were working with the union.
You are butchering up animals. You know, that goes on today in meat packing plants. This is not a pleasant job. Mm-mm. It is an unhealthy job. It's a dangerous job. And people are terribly underpaid. But, you know, with the packing house, and then you had in Chicago at that time, without going into labor history. You know,
A little bit.
All right, you had, you know, often you had people from, you know, Poland were there. You had people from Eastern Europe were gravitating there. You had blacks who were there. You know, so what they had, people speaking all kinds of languages. So the union had to translate all this stuff, bring people together in a common front against the employer. But, you know, what happened in the 30s, the growth of trade unionism in America, as you mentioned a moment ago, certainly became political. If you think that Roosevelt's transformative legislation during the 30s was by accident, it wasn't. These were the demands often made by the unions. So what you saw is ordinary people standing up to incredible power and saying that in solidarity, united, we can do well for our families. We got to come together. And the hurdles, and you know, not only all of the power of corporations, we remember the thugs from Ford Motor Company beating up Walter Ruther and these guys who were trying to organize, but saying, you form a union, your job is gone. And God knows how many people, you got to go home to your wife and say, you know, I fired because I tried to form a union. People say, I'm not going to do that. You know, tremendous pressure and all the brainwashing that people got. People got beaten up by the police, etc. But to me, it, you know, what human life, the advancement of human life is when people are coming together, overcoming race and religion and ethnic backgrounds, which is certainly what was the case in Chicago. You have to overcome all that to stand together to say, you know, we're human beings. We're entitled to a decent standard of living. Companies making all kinds of money, they've got to provide decently for us as workers. And I think, you know, we got to expand upon that. And organized labor can become a major, major political power in this country with an agenda that speaks to the needs of workers and not just, you know, the CEOs.
So one thing that we do in the book is obviously we try to explore a lot of ideas for where you might go if we actually got our act together as a country, mm-hmm. right? If we kind of, if we open some of these doors to the some real new possibilities. And there's a substantial section on worker ownership.
Yeah.
And that has been a passion of yours
for
a long time.
Back, but I was mayor in Burlington in the 1980s. I'll never forget it. We did a town meeting, if you like, in City Hall, you know, on that issue. The place was mobbed. There was a lot of interest in it. All right, and this is what it gets back to. You know, it gets back to what we mean about democracy. Is it just the right to vote every 2 years? What democracy means to me is the right for you to control your own life. So if you go to work for 40 or 50 hours a week, and you have nothing to say about the job. Right? Boss makes all the decisions. Here, John, you got to do all of these things, and we'll check you out at the end of the week. You become less of a human being. You have brains, but you're not allowed to use your brains to try to improve what you're producing or the work that you're doing. You just are a cog in a machine. You're taking orders from somebody else. And I think what we have seen over the last many years is a growth in ESOPs and a growth in worker-owned companies. I will tell you that in Vermont, and we've been fairly active in this, you have workers now who, you know, elect their own, you know, bosses, their own managers, who share the profits, who determine what the salaries are, worker-owned companies. And you walk into those companies, and it is very, very different than walking into a normal company. There's a certain pride, and people feel very differently about the company. It's their company. Why not? They're the boss. They own it. And they make the decisions. And that makes them, I think, more human. To say, you know what, things aren't working well. We can do this better. We can do that better. Let's talk about it, rather than somebody on top making that decision. So, you know, what democracy is about is not just voting every 4 years. Is how do we have as much control over possible in our lives? And you can't ignore that you're working 40 or 50 hours a week. You can't ignore the fact that many people, and we don't talk about this at all. You know, I'm not saying this, you know, who knows what the statistics are. But there are clearly millions of people who are going to wake up tomorrow morning and they're going to be, oh God, I've got to go to work. I hate my job, but I've got to go to work because I need the paycheck to feed my family, right? Millions of people. Well, let's create a situation where people are excited about going to work because they are part of that process. They may help make those decisions. That's what worker ownership is about.
And it's these employee stock ownership plans, right? They can operate on a lot of different models. There's, and we don't have to go into the details of it. But that's, so there's really a couple ways where you can get a better control of your work life. One is to have a very strong union.
Right.
Right? And that can really counterbalance the company. Another is to actually own your company, right? To run it and stuff like that.
And one of the things we're trying to do, we've had some success, is provide money. We have legislation in which is half passed. It's authorized, not yet funded, for employee ownership programs, which says right now you have many, many, 67-year-old people who started their own company. Now they got 50 employees, and they want to retire. And maybe they don't have kids that they're going to give the business to. They would just as soon give it to their employees. Many of them have worked for them for years. How do you do that? What kind of, are there any tax breaks available for you? So we're trying to help make, you know, small, medium-sized businesses understand how they can transfer the business to their own workers.
And that actually, it for communities around this country, that might save a local industry
you
that otherwise could disappear.
Right. If you own your own business, you're not going to take it to China or Mexico,
yeah.
Right?
Let me ask you one other aspect of work, which is not often brought into discussions like this, but you have always understood, partially because you represent Vermont in the U.S. Senate, is that a portion of Americans' working class is farmers and people who work on farms. And a lot of the policy of this country has been very oriented toward big ag, toward, you know, very, very powerful interests as regards our food systems and that. You've always been very interested, and we talk about it a little bit in the book, the importance of making sure that we shore up the working people that grow our food, that produce, you know, the largesse of this country.
I always got a kick out of my right-wing friends who want to get rid of all of the illegal immigrants in America. Well, if they did that, price of food would triple the next day or something like that, because who do they think are doing the work? I remember I was out in Immokalee, Florida. You know where that is?
I do. It's a little town down on Lake. It's on
Sean,
lake.
You're one of the three people in the world outside of Florida who knows where Immokalee is.
One of the one persons in the world who actually wrote about it when you went there.
Maybe that helped.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was years and years ago, and we did a hearing on it. These were mostly undocumented workers who had no power. Man, were they exploited. They'd sit in the fields for hours if it rained, and they didn't get paid for it, and they get paid. Minimally, the housing was absolutely disgusting. I think we have some impact in improving life there a little bit. But it is, you know, it's not only the farm workers in America, people that Cesar Chavez talked about and helped organize. It is, you know, family farms.
Working farmers.
And one of the things that's very sad, whether it's your state of Wisconsin or my state of Vermont, is we're seeing, you know, family-based agriculture going under. And being replaced by fewer and fewer larger and larger corporate entities. And, you talk to young people who grew up on family farms, there are worse lives than growing up on a family farm. There's a lot to be said for that. So I hope that we can continue to support family-based agriculture, no matter, you know, what the product that people are producing may be. It's good for communities. And also, and that takes you to the issue of nutrition, and making sure that our people not only have enough food, but have good quality food, which is also often locally grown, hopefully organic type of products.
When we talk about a farmer labor movement, right, where we bring farmers and workers together, it should be in the contemporary moment, but it actually in many senses recalls a century ago when you had people like Eugene Victor Debs and Robert M. La Follette and others going out and saying that we've got to organize in this way. And in the book, Debs comes up quite a bit because he's always been something of a hero of yours. He was a labor leader.
Let me stop and say this. I wonder how many people, you know, people who are listening to this or seeing this. Debs, who is Eugene V. Debs?
Yeah.
Well, way back when in the 1970s, before I was mayor of Burlington, I don't know, I was speaking to some class or something, and I asked people, have you ever heard of Eugene Debs? Not a hand. I think it was the University of Vermont. And not a hand went up. No one had heard of him. So I went out and I did a video, non-sophisticated,
rudimentary.
Rudimentary is the word, a video. But it was good. It was okay. But you have somebody like Eugene Debs, who was a great, great American hero. A guy who was a member way back in the 1880s, 1890s, of the American Rail Union, helped bring workers in the rail industry at that point, you know, a huge number of workers, together into a big union. I was involved in the great Pullman strike, and then helped form the Socialist Party and ran for president 5 times, I think from 1896 through, 1912?
1900 to 1920, my friend.
1920,
yeah,
okay.
Last time. He did it from jail.
That was 1916 when he was in jail.
Trust me.
Okay. And he ran. Why did he go to jail? Well, tell the listeners.
He went to jail because he spoke out against World War I.
He didn't go to jail for one of the reasons that Trump might go to jail. A very different reason.
Different.
Trump goes to jail. Well, he's not going to go to jail, but, you know, he's indicted because all of his greed and illegal behavior. Debs went to jail because of his opposition to World War I. Mm-hmm. He stood up and, you know, without going into all the details, was arrested, sent to Terre Haute.
He sent down to. He's from Terre Haute. He got sent down to the Atlanta Penitentiary.
Atlanta Penitentiary. Yeah. You're right. Atlanta.
You got little. You can get a pin with. They have pins in that campaign with him and his cell number.
Anyhow, yeah. The guy goes to jail. He was in jail for 3 years, and he was in his 60s at the time, and he came out in much worse health than when he went in. He died, I don't know, some years later, but this was a guy who was almost like a Christ-like figure, and the people who knew him, everybody loved him. He'd give you the shirt off of his back, and he helped organize workers. And he did the right thing by opposing a war that probably the United States should never have gotten into in the first place. Is a life that people should know about, and in my view, really respect. So that's why I did the video on him, and why we talk about him in the book.
And he had a great line. He said, and I'm just paraphrasing, but it was, if I could lead you into paradise, I wouldn't do it. Because if I could lead you in, somebody else could lead you out. And his basic message there was, and I think it's also been a message of yours throughout your career, that people need to, they need to learn about the issues, but then they need to do it themselves. They have to organize the movements.
You don't need great leaders. You need great mass movements of people. And out of those, you know, mass movements will become people, become leaders who are accountable to an educated and organized organization. The other thing about Debs, which always moves me, actually is a little bit of a film clip about it. He was such a decent human being. Guy goes to jail. And when he leaves, he's walking out of the prison in Atlanta. I don't know if you remember this. All of the prisoners are banging their tin cups against the bars, thanking him. Can you imagine that? Guy's in jail, guy's in his 60s, and he was so loved by the prisoners. His humanity really came across that all these prisoners are just, you know, it was a very moving moment for him as well. But, you know, what your point is well taken. Debs never wanted to be a quote-unquote great leader. What he wanted to do is develop a movement of people who would stand up and fight for their rights.
That's a very good point at which to circle around this segment and to tell people that they should stick with us, because we just talked about a great figure in American history.
Tell them to buy the book too.
Well, it makes a fine holiday gift. But we're talking about a great figure in American history, Eugene Victor Debs, who went to jail for speaking out in a time of war and dissenting and raising real questions about where the United States was headed. And the next segment we're going to do is going to look at the bipartisan foreign policy consensus in the United States and how an awful lot of people are saying maybe it's time for us to make a big change in that. So I hope
you mean that bipartisan consensus, which is almost always wrong.
Yes, that is the one.
That's the consensus.
That's the one we'll be discussing.
Okay. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.